Hey, listeners, before we get into this episode, we wanted to give you a quick content warning. The second question that we tackle is about pregnancy, but it also is going to deal with some things that go along with it. And we know that that can be a sensitive area for a lot of you out there. So we wanted you to be prepared if you want to skip that question, or maybe this whole episode. By all means, please do, and we'll see you on the next one. Okay, let's get into the show. Hello and welcome to another episode of That's Absurd, Please Elaborate. I am here comprising today one third of the hosting party, group, rating organization.
Troop, yeah. Troop. With a U.
Gang. I'm Julian Huguet, joined as always by Trace Dominguez. And today we have a very special guest. She's a host of Tiny Matters, the podcast brought to you by the American Chemical Society. We've had her co-host on before in a previous episode, and now we complete the set. Please welcome Deboki Chakravarti. Woo!
I'm excited to be here.
Deboki, tell us about yourself first. Let us get to know you.
Everything. Yeah. I'll start from the beginning.
Okay, yeah. When were you born?
I am a freelance science writer. My background is in biomedical engineering, so that's what I studied in undergrad and then went to grad school for it and like worked on figuring out how to make immune cells fight cancer, which was a lot of fun, but I was like, don't want to do that forever. It's hard, it turns out, but I realized I liked writing, and so then I moved over to being a science writer, and so now that's what I do. I write YouTube videos and podcasts, including Tiny Matters.
Very cool. That's awesome.
Always great when we have somebody with what's the word, Trace?
Actual science?
That's it, qualifications.
Yeah. Yeah, that's always nice.
Oh, one of those. You got one of them fancy degrees.
Yeah, I don't know where it is anymore. Every time I write about poop, I'm like, this is what I got my PhD for. This is what I did it for.
I like that it's every time I write about poop.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it happens a lot.
Yeah.
My wife's getting a biology degree right now, and literally the amount of crap she has to deal with. Like,
hey.
Yeah.
But she's not here.
No, she is in Ecuador. We mentioned this as we record our actual first anniversary, quote unquote, on Leap Day. And she is she's gone. She missed our first anniversary. We waited 4 years for it.
So can I ask, when do you guys like usually celebrate your anniversary?
So we agreed, like, I thought I was going to get away with it once every 4 years, you know, because I'm a cheapskate.
That's too long. You're gonna always forget.
That's what, yeah. Everybody's always like, oh, so you'd have to get one present every 4 years. And I'm like, yeah. The judgment coming through from everyone. But no, we agreed February 28th. And March 1st, but I said it should be the 24-hour period in the middle, so from noon to noon.
Yeah, I think I like that makes the most sense. You get a dinner on the 28th, and then like a breakfast on the 1st.
If my head pops off my pillow on the 28th, and I'm like, oh no, I got nothing. I technically have time to go out and get chocolates and flowers.
You have daytime that you can deal with.
Yeah. I have a small window to be a good spouse.
That's funny.
But it's only those 24 hours.
That's it.
The rest of the year, don't have to be a good spouse.
On March 1st, don't expect any more affection from me until next year.
Yeah. That's it.
Yep.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
So does that mean then leap year, is that like a full 48 hours?
Oh, are you no. Like, now we're getting greedy. Now, that's not when Julius Caesar invented the leap day. That's not what we had in mind, right? That's no. It's you get the one extra day that's accumulated over the 4 years. That's it.
Yeah.
24 hours. Yeah. Done. Well, I'm looking forward to this because, Deboki, you had some excellently absurd questions, and Trace decided to take one of those on. Trace, what question did you choose to answer?
So, Deboki, you asked, would squirrels still be so annoying if we weren't around to observe them?
I'm so excited. I'm so excited that you picked this.
This is one of those rare, like, the question made us ask a lot of questions, like, Deboki.
We were like, wait a minute.
What's up with you and squirrels?
I think I literally looked out a window and saw a squirrel and was remembering, like, how much I hate squirrels.
Was it taunting you?
What? So, yeah. Not that particular one, but in college, in the house that I lived in, there were squirrels that lived in our attic, and they would make all of this noise. They just were not good neighbors at all. And like at one point, one of my roommates was trying to walk back into the house, and like there were just squirrels on the front porch, like yelling at her and not letting her enter. And so I've just always, like, since then, have thought of squirrels as deeply, deeply annoying creatures.
I like this, like, West Side Story squirrel gang that's, like, on your porch, like, smoking and, like, snapping their fingers. Yeah. Like, what are you doing here?
I'm picturing squirrel construction workers on lunch break.
Oh, even worse.
Hey, girl. Yeah. Hey.
No, that's a great, like, because once I would also get onto campus, it wasn't a reprieve. Like the squirrels were still like a nightmare. They were like, they were always in your way. They were always like, I feel like there's a way in which they're just always around and they're doing something that feels annoying.
I love it. I love it so much. So we read your questions, and she submitted, by the way, audience, like 3 or 4, which, and they were all great, but I saw this one and I thought, this is awfully amazing. Like, I have to, it felt so autobiographical.
And it is. It is. I just told you my story. This resentment has lasted for more than a decade. Like, I have moved to the other side of the country. The squirrels here are nicer, and I still don't trust them.
Ugh, amazing.
Well, you know, so East Coast squirrels are rude, but California squirrels, they're nice to your face, but then they talk smack about you behind your back.
It's
true.
Right.
That's how we do it on the West Coast.
Yeah.
Well, let me dig into this a little bit then. So I spent some time thinking about how I would answer this question, and I decided to mostly focus on what it means to be annoyed, just generally.
Yeah.
But still kind of keep it around the squirrel. So what is a squirrel? Right? It's
so philosophical.
When you think about squirrels, it's a small or medium-sized rodent. They're related to chipmunks, prairie dogs, tree squirrels, ground squirrels, flying squirrels, and they're native to Africa, Eurasia, and the Americas. Basically, it's a rodent. It's actually the smartest of the rodents by some measures, which is pretty cool, which I'll come back to in a second.
This is now turning my annoyance to fear.
That's right. They are devious. They can pretend that they're doing something that they're not actually doing. They are communicative with other squirrels. It's very cool. Steve Sullivan, the head of Project Squirrel, which is a citizen science project, and the curator of the Chicago Academy of Sciences, told Atlas Obscura that sometimes he thinks squirrels are North America's version of monkeys.
Oh, interesting.
Which I think makes total sense based on what you've just said. I've never been to a country where there are monkeys, you know, all around. But everyone I know who's been there is like, they're always underfoot. They're always there trying to bug you about something. They're like either trying to get food from you or they're throwing things or they're, you know. And everything you just said about squirrels on campus and then back on the East Coast is that they're there. They're always annoying and like in your way, which is so interesting.
That definitely tracks because I've like, the parts of India that my family is from doesn't have a lot of monkeys, but when I've been to the parts that that do, it is like, they are there. They will let you know.
That's funny. Just some fun facts about squirrels. They have great memories. They have to, you know, bury seeds and nuts around. That's part of their behavior. So they'll bury these stashes, and they could stash as many as 10,000 different nuts a year. And they have to remember where those are so that they can eat when food gets scarce in the winter. They're really, really good at this. It's probably their most famous trait and also their most ecologically significant trait. A UC Berkeley study used human students to see if they could do what squirrels do. They literally asked them to bury plastic eggs and then go find them again later. They waited 15 minutes. I just want you to know that it was a 15-minute wait. They're like, they buried a dozen eggs and they had to go find them. And they told them that they could do the same thing squirrels do, which is try and steal from each other or like see other people's stashes or protect their stashes. Which I would pay to watch.
This is what undergrad students that were forced to do. This feels. Yeah. This just feels like hazing. Like,
okay, everybody. Here's a dozen eggs. Go outside in the lawn and bury them.
You think you're so cool? All right, go. You be squirrels for my enjoyment.
For science. It's for science. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Totally for science.
Fight each other over peanuts.
Turns out they were really bad at it, and they couldn't find a lot of eggs that they had buried.
Relatable. Honestly, I can't find anything I set down 15 minutes ago.
Right.
My ADHD's like, weren't you holding coffee? And it's like, I was. Where is it?
Somehow it's in the fridge? I don't know why I'm not sure what it's in the fridge.
It's in the bathroom. I don't know how it got here.
Yeah. Can't be expected to like keep track of things.
Can't be done. Can't be done. I would have planted a lot of coffee trees were I a squirrel.
Ah, good transition.
Thank you.
That is the best part about that stash system. Is the reason it's ecologically significant is because they plant seeds basically, because they also do forget
unwittingly.
You know, they don't remember all 10,000 of these and go, okay, well, we've got database entry number 7. We've got database entry number 12. You know, they forget them and then they just end up growing into plants, which is great for the environment. So that's why squirrels are somehow, you know, good. They also could be able to learn in more maybe sciencey science. They put puzzles out around in Cambridge, Massachusetts and Cambridgeshire in the UK, funnily enough. And they had puzzles that these squirrels could solve. And turns out, with these plastic boxes with food puzzles, native urban squirrels, they would solve complex puzzles that had two or more kind of moving parts. They could do it 70% of the time on the first try. But the rural squirrels could only do it 30% of the time.
Huh.
Which I'll come back to why that's cool in a minute. 25 days later, when presented with the same puzzle, the rural squirrels remembered how to solve it, and the urban squirrels were like, I'm going to have to figure this out again. And they did bad.
I was going to say, rural squirrel has got to be the hardest word to say.
Did I do okay? I feel like it was
rural squirrel.
Yeah.
Especially if you have a German accent. The squirrel's got to be the hardest word to say with a squirrel.
Yeah. My mother-in-law is Brazilian, and she has that rural. She has a problem with words like world, so I don't even ever. I've never even heard her say squirrel. I can't imagine.
I feel like every experiment you're describing, I'm like now stacking up my intelligence against the squirrels. Like we established better at remembering stuff where they put their food. But I feel like I could do a puzzle faster than the squirrel. Like, especially if there's food, I think I've got them beat.
Well, I'm glad you said that because our fourth guest today is... Bring out the squirrel with the puzzle. We're going to find out. I see you sweating over there now.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Are you smarter than a squirrel? Brought to you by Planters Peanuts.
Planters? That's so good. Anyway.
I'm sorry. I had to.
Continue, please.
Oh, yes, of course. So that's great that you mentioned that that squirrels are brought into the studio because they were popular as pets from the 1700s and 1800s. They actually had a pet name. You know how like dogs we have, they're all named Rover or Fido or Doggo or whatever. Squirrels in the 1700s and 1800s were called Skug. It was like the cute pet name for squirrels. Yeah.
Is there any like etymology for that? Like,
I don't know. I didn't look that up to Bokey. I was just like this. I'm just going to take this at face value.
I need to come back on the podcast to ask why Skug. Like, where did Skug come from?
So wait, I learned this because in 1722, a pet squirrel named Mungo slipped out of its owner's cage and was killed by a dog.
Oh.
And that person who owned the squirrel was friends with Benjamin Franklin. So Benjamin Franklin wrote them a letter and said, "Few squirrels were better accomplished. He had a good education, traveled far, and had seen much of the world. Thou art fallen by the fangs of wanton, cruel Ranger." That was the name of the dog. And then wrote an epitaph, "Here Skug lies snug as a bug in a rug." That's Ben Franklin, everybody.
Every word in that sentence was a surprise.
Is that weird? Mungo the squirrel, R.I.P.
Why is it that we know Ben Franklin for things like lightning keys or whatever, but like not for this, not for the squirrel letter, not for the eulogy for the dead squirrel pet?
I don't know. Man, this should be definitely like top of the Wikipedia page for sure. Ben Franklin.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So all this is to say that squirrels are pretty smart. They're food motivated. They can be trained. They can be tamed. And because of that, they live commonly near humans. In fact, a lot like pigeons, they're considered what's called a synanthrope, which is an undomesticated organism that benefits and thrives by living near humans. Ooh. So any urban animal you would see in like New York City, Los Angeles, or anywhere else in the world, you know, mice, rats, raccoons, pigeons, rabbits, and in some parts of the world, coyote, deer, fox, and squirrels, of course. Interestingly, on the list was also robins, which are pretty common in the U.S., but that's actually they live in the forest, but we see them a lot in cities because they're synanthropes. They actually thrive when they're around humans. They get food from us, they get shelter from us, and so I thought that was pretty cool. So we see squirrels a lot, in part because they live better, I guess, when they're around us than they did even in nature. So, just to recap, studies have found also that squirrels feel a kind of frustration and agitation, so they can feel a similar feeling to that. They play and tease other animals, so that's probably what they were doing to you on campus. They're forgetful, of course. They feel anxiety and stress. They can exhibit paranoia and deception, which I sort of teased earlier. And by that, I mean when they think they're being watched, they will pretend to bury the nut that they're carrying. They'll literally dig a hole, like rummage around in the hole and then like pat it down and scrape grass over it. But the whole time they had the nut like in their mouth or in their armpit and they were just hiding it from you, thinking that you're trying to get their nuts, which I think is hilarious. So anyway, squirrels, they're pretty cool. So I wrote this not knowing exactly what you found annoying, but from what you mentioned, you said you were annoyed by the noise. They tried to live in your house and then they would like bother you behavioral wise.
Yes.
So I sort of did get into some of that in my research. They're very twitchy. A lot of people find that weird about them. And that's because we've mentioned before on the podcast, fast twitch muscles versus slow twitch. They have a lot more fast twitch muscles. They can't run marathons, but they can kind of twitch around and move. Their hind legs are stronger than their front legs, which makes them great jumpers. But that does mean that they can't go very far all the time. Like they can't be running around. So they end up trying to find safety in trees or underground if they're a ground squirrel, etc. And turns out we make our houses out of trees, so they eat into the house to find safety. And they do this in part, too, because their teeth never stop growing, similar to, like, their cousin, the beaver. They have to chew on things to wear down their teeth. So they just can't help it. They have to chew on stuff. And they also can't digest cellulose, so they usually chew on wood nuts and seeds and, you know, other things like that to kind of wear down their teeth. Because if they don't do that, it would mess up their faces. So they eat these, like, 4-inch, 10-centimeter holes to get into our houses where it's nice and warm. Again, synanthropes. So, sorry. You mentioned specifically the sound, which I think is really cool. American squirrels are super chatty, even more than European squirrels, and that is very annoying. I don't know if you've ever seen a squirrel on a tree and they start going like, and like really getting angry at you. That's because you're probably near one of their stashes and they get upset. Or maybe you have a dog with you and they're thinking about poor Mungo.
So American squirrels are more like, get off my property! And European squirrels are more communal. Got it.
Yeah, exactly. It. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that made an even stronger comparison than I thought of.
Squirrels are just mirrors for us, is what I'm learning.
Yeah.
Wow. You just wait till we get to the end of this, because that's where I'm going.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. We all end up being empathetic naked squirrel people again, like episode 3.
Oh, no. Like episode 3.
Yeah.
So things that we find annoying. There's not a lot of research on annoyance, but one of the things that people genuinely find annoying, especially in urban environments, is hearing half of a conversation, right? Like if you hear somebody talking and you can't hear the, oh, yeah, right, yeah, and then she was totally, like, is that annoying to you?
I'm already irritated just hearing that example.
I also find it annoying when people voice text in public, when they're like, you can see them holding their phone and they're like,
well, that just looks ridiculous too. I don't know why.
It's
I shouldn't judge them, but seeing somebody hold their phone like that flat, and I do it too, but when I see it, I'm like, look at this idiot. Like,
when you catch yourself in the mirror, look at that. It's me.
And it's all
I don't do voice to text enough, so I always kind of love it because I love seeing people say the punctuation out loud. Like there's the classic scene from Real Housewives of New York where Luann, one of the women, is like sending this deeply emotional text like related to her fiance cheating on her, but she has to add like period or question mark.
And then
or
I saw
like
it, semicolon, another woman's.
I wonder how many people voice text the semicolon.
Me, all the time. Big proponent of the semicolon.
For Firstly, we should have whole unpacking of the Real Housewives franchises later, Tobokie, you and me, because I'm a big fan.
Yo, get Sam on it, too. So,
like, yeah.
Oh, Sam and I, we have our recordings for that for Tiny Matters. We've had to, like, bake in extra time because we, like, we're catching up on Vanderpump Rules, Summer House. I'm getting her started on Real Housewives. She just did all
She's
Salt Lake
just
City.
Getting going? Oh.
Guys, because you know, they've been going on
squirrels.
So long.
Sorry, sidebar. Okay. Check out our other podcast, Real Housewives of Our Podcast. Okay, so you're hearing a conversation. You're hearing half of one. It's annoying. And the reason is our brains evolved to pick up on that conversation, and we like predictable things. It's more easy to pick up on things that are predictable. There's actually a term for this. The half-a-log is something that you hear. You only hear half of the conversation. You can't predict it. It makes you frustrated, which totally makes sense. So humans are very good at what's called verbal shadowing. You've seen it in like every improv game ever where somebody's like, okay, let's sing a song at the same time. And people get pretty good at it, even if they've never heard the song before. They're literally making it up. We are very good at this. But this got me to thinking about why that's annoying. There is a book called Annoying, The Science of What Bugs Us by Flora Lichtman and Joe Palca. They're both NPR hosts, interestingly. But they created the three U's of universal annoyance. Unpredictable, unpleasant, which is to say like not harmful or it's usually trivial, uncertain duration, so you can't escape it. And then I added to it after reading all of this, unable to ignore it. So our brain picks up on it. It's unpredictable. We don't know what's happening. It's unpleasant. We don't want to listen to it, but we have to because our brain won't let us not. And then we don't know how long it's going to go on. Are they going to talk for this entire time that we're on this train? Or do they, or like, how am I going to, you know, and that becomes already just thinking about it, I'm annoyed. And so we have these universally annoying things like fingernails on a chalkboard. And it's because it's unpredictable. It's unpleasant. We don't know how long it's going to last and we can't ignore it. And it's also rough acoustically and sounds a little bit like a scream. It's a similar acoustic signature to screaming, which is something that we evolved to not be able to ignore. So anyway, all of those are why things are annoying. The authors think that it's not easily studied because there are researchers who do things about anger and there are researchers who do things about frustration. But I think we can all agree that annoyance isn't really either of those things, right? It's something else. Mm-hmm. And so it's harder to pin down.
Yeah.
They think the authors of this book think it comes from our ancient brain, you know, bad smells that we can't ignore, mm-hmm. has to do with low oxygen or toxicity, bad sounds like screams we can't ignore. Maybe it's trying to trigger our fight or flight reaction, but it's not enough to trigger it. And our brain is like, we know that this isn't dangerous, but we can't like ignore the fight or flight part of it. So one of the authors told the American Psychological Association in an interview for their website, quote, "It doesn't feel right. I don't want to be here." And then I added a but. "We've socialized it and we've made it physically less dangerous. So it's just left with being annoying or irritating." So to answer your question is, would squirrels still be so annoying if we weren't around to observe them? I think the simple answer is no, because they're synanthropic. If there weren't humans around, there wouldn't be as many of them. But they are annoying because we built our houses of the thing that they live in. So they chew through it because they have to. And that's why they lived in your attic, because you were providing them shelter and they happen to thrive in human environments. But because they are so adapted to us, without us, they just wouldn't be as around. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't be as annoying. But we find them annoying because they are very similar to us. Or there was a really interesting interview that I read for this in Glamour magazine about irritating human beings. They cited a therapist, Jodi Karas, and she said, there are people in the world that just irritate you just by existing, right? Mm-hmm. How many times have you met somebody and you're like, oh, I'm not into this person.
Yeah.
And what happens is, according to Dr. Karas, we are projecting. We see bits of ourselves in them.
Oh.
So we are irritated because we cannot ignore or push down or be, you know, things that we're embarrassed by about ourselves, we're seeing in the squirrel.
Oh, no. I was not prepared.
That's what I'm trying to say.
to hear that.
Like, they're called shadow elements.
I feel very called out right
Everyone
now.
Everyone you dislike is actually a part of yourself you dislike.
Yeah.
Yes.
I, too, have been hiding in attics and yelling at people trying to enter their rooms. Homes.
That's what I love doing that. So maybe that's why I like squirrels.
So what Dr. Karas recommends about, I'm going to say, and extrapolate to Deboki to your squirrel annoyance, is to pay close attention to the reactions that you feel when you're around a squirrel. Probe them to see what your feelings are and what you're feeling. Listen to your gut.
Yeah.
And just, you know, what exactly is irritating about this squirrel-Deboki interaction? You should reflect on your experiences. Is this a, you know, something that was in your past that you have trauma about? You should discuss this with your friends or a professional if needed.
Consider the squirrel. And while you're doing that, I'll be over here stealing your nuts.
Yeah. I'm going to like go text my therapist right now. I got to talk about squirrels.
Listen, I've been thinking about squirrels a lot lately, and I've had some real breakthroughs.
Yeah.
I hope that answered your question to your satisfaction.
No, that did. That was super interesting because I haven't really, like, I mean, obviously I thought about the fact that, like, we're having this interaction because we're both here, right? Like, we're both in each other's vicinity. So, like, clearly part of this is, like, on me seeing them and engaging with them, but, like, understanding more about, like, how their lifestyle is, like, so intertwined with ours is super fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And definitely, I think part of that annoyance, right, is like, it's in my space, and to the squirrel, you're in its space.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is that overlap.
There was a piece that I read for this where it was like, the things you should hate most about squirrels. And it was like, they eat your bird seed. And I was like, all right, mom.
Yeah.
And then the other thing was like, they define their territory and they don't let you define their territory, which I thought was really interesting. Like, they decide where they're going to go and what is there. You don't get to pick, which I thought was very cool. And that makes sense with the annoyance part of it, is kind of to your point. They're going to be there.
Yep.
So, you know, let's figure out why we're so annoyed by them and see if we can get past
this,
it.
This went so much deeper than I expected. This was literally therapeutic in a small way. So thanks, Deboki.
Now I want to know, like, are they annoyed with me?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess so. It sounds like with
so
the yelling at the dogs and everything.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, they do have a communicative ability. Usually their tails, they twitch them a lot. Mm-hmm. So if you've seen a squirrel with its tail kind of up and it's like twitching it, it's communicating to other squirrels nearby. Maybe it's agitated or frustrated, but it also could be like, there's a predator here, which I thought that's pretty neat.
I bet this time next year, Deboki has a pet squirrel. Named Skug.
Named Skug.
In the squirrel tradition.
Right.
Yeah. So with that, let's take a quick break and come back with the question that Deboki chose to answer. If you've turned into this...
You've turned into a science comedy podcast. Oh, no. Oh, no. I'm a podcast. Am I going to be late to work?
If you're tuned into this science and comedy podcast, chances are that you are someone who loves learning and having a blast while doing it.
If it wasn't clear, Trace and I are the same way. We thrive on learning new things because it not only enriches our lives, helps us learn new skills, but also makes us really cool at parties.
Is that what we are at parties?
Aren't we? We are, right? We're cool.
I mean, when you're at my house and I'm at your house, definitely, but like... other houses.
Anyway, this is all to say, I am super excited about our new sponsor, Brilliant.
Yay!
Can I kind of get a little, like, you know, in my feels for a second?
Oh, yeah. Get those feels. Elaborate, please.
Hey, I see what you did there. I am exactly the kind of person that Brilliant was made for. I have always been interested in math, physics, computer science. When I had the chance to study these things in college years ago, I was also really intimidated by them.
Yeah.
And I avoided taking these classes. And honestly, I regret it. I'm going back now. I'm taking classes at my local community college. I'm loving it.
Yeah.
But with a family and work, traditional classes like that, I'm finding them really hard to actually fit into my life. So I was really excited when you told me that Brilliant was going to be a sponsor.
That's awesome, man. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
If you don't know what it is, by the way, out there.
It's an interactive learning platform with so many lessons on topics that I always wanted to explore, and I can do them at my own pace, on my schedule, and in a way that keeps me engaged.
You can learn by doing on their website or with their mobile apps. And there are thousands of different interactive lessons in STEM subjects all across the platform.
Their lessons are engaging and interactive.
You can brush up on like algebra or advanced math, multivariable calculus, differential equations,
computer science, Python programming. You can even learn about cutting edge stuff like large language models, neural networks, the things that are powering AI today.
Large language models, really big right now.
Large language models.
You can learn large language models.
It's only Gaelic, though. The large language that you can learn is Gaelic.
Yeah, ship that. I'm in.
We can finally communicate with the Scots.
Okay, well, anyway. Wherever you are in your learning journey, there is a brilliant course that will help you get to the next level. Or, you know, just be basic enough to get you an understanding that you can go and work with.
Yeah, they're always adding new courses too. They just launched a ton of lessons focused on analyzing data.
That's cool. That's really cool.
I think the world would be a better place if everyone had to take a stats class.
Oh, totally.
And if you haven't taken one, here's your chance.
You could just go take a statistics class and make Julian so, so happy.
I would appreciate that.
Try it out.
You can try Brilliant for free for 30 days. Just visit brilliant.org/absurd or click the link in the show notes.
Once again, that's brilliant.org/absurd.
When you sign up, you'll get 20% off the annual premium subscription, and it supports the show, even just trying it out.
So go ahead, check it out, maybe get sucked into a few lessons. Trace and I are going to be here with the rest of the episode when you get back. If you get back.
Oh, I hope you get back.
They come back and they know more than us about everything.
They're just like, these guys are idiots.
Their brains are the size, the huge brain coming out of their cranium. I've absorbed all knowledge.
Why do I listen to this podcast of dummies?
I have no time for your absurd antics.
But I would definitely take one on large language models. That'd be cool.
A Scottish AI robot that nobody can understand.
Sally, turn on the lights! Sally!
I'm the burglar alarm.
It supports the show. It'll be great. And welcome back to That's Absurd, Please Elaborate. We just talked about squirrels for 20 minutes. You're welcome. Everybody feeling good? Great. So next up, Deboki is going to answer a question that she got from our audience. Deboki, what was your question?
So the question I'm going to answer is, can any mammals other than humans tell if they're pregnant? And this was asked by ADHD Newman.
I love just that the username, by the way, right? It's like 80HD. And yeah. It reminds me of this joke that it still makes me laugh every time I think of it, where this guy's like, I don't know what HD is, but the doctor said I have 80 of them.
Okay, I got it.
Which, ironically, I was able to focus on the squirrel answer very easily for someone with 80 HDs. Is this kind of up your alley, or was this a little out of your normal comfort zone for you, Deboki?
It's a little bit up my alley. I've gotten very interested in pregnancy science over the past few years. I've had a few pregnancies. They were miscarriages, so just from context. But I've just become so interested in the biology and, like, evolution and history of mm-hmm. pregnancy. And so that was part of why I was really excited for this question. It also took me on a lot of different journeys that I hadn't originally anticipated, which was really, exciting for me.
This whole episode is like a really learning, growing experience, apparently, just for you, Deboki.
Yeah. We're really examining all of my issues today.
Hey, it'll be fun. And also, we're going to kind of wade through a lot of trauma here.
Yeah. So the central question for me at the end of the day with this question became, what does it mean to even know that you're pregnant? We'll get there.
Okay.
So I'm just going to start off with the things that make me feel like they should know that they're pregnant. Like if I'm just thinking about how animals act, like, what are the things that feel like they know that they're pregnant? And I came up with two things that I was thinking about. One is just that, like, animal behaviors will change when they're pregnant. So one of the examples that I found was from domesticated cattle. And so in cattle and cows, when they're pregnant, people will usually observe them walking around and sniffing things. They'll apparently raise their tails more. So these are all like behaviors that are, like, documented as things that they just do more. And part of that might be, like, especially later on in their pregnancy, they might walk around more because they're uncomfortable. And so, like, that's just like a way of getting more comfortable. Another big example comes from mice. Apparently, female mice who have never been sexually active, they do not care about baby mice. They won't groom them, and they will sometimes maybe even kill them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah. Like, when we're saying disinterested, we mean it.
Like, humans are just like, please give me an airplane with no kids on it. And baby mice are like, I'm going to kill this. Yeah. I'm going to kill it. I'm going to murder it.
This airline operates by the law of mice. Beware, parents.
Yep. Yeah, it's like, wow. We just were talking about annoyance.
Yeah. Like, How long is it going to last? Not much longer.
Oh, God.
But the thing is, like, we just talked about murderous mice. Once they become pregnant, like, that shifts. Like, after they have babies, they're incredibly attentive, and they'll put a lot of effort into their young. So scientists wanted to understand, like, kind of what's going on. And again, like, when I look at these behavioral changes, there's a part of me that just kind of, like, wants to be like, oh, they must know. Like, I don't know that the science bears out, but it just feels like it.
I've heard another example that makes me think of that, and it has to do with horses.
Oh, interesting.
So apparently, and this is top of my head, so forgive me if I'm inaccurate, but, like, horses, apparently, when a female horse, I know they all have specific names, I can never remember any of them. When it gets pregnant, it'll go and copulate with all the other male horses in the paddock. And the reason apparently is because when a horse has a baby horse, the other male horses, if it's not theirs, will kill it or try to kill it. So in order to protect the as yet unborn baby horse, the mommy horse will go and sleep with all the other, I guess they do it awake, all the other horses. She probably should be awake for that.
I think humans do mostly.
You know
too.
What? You've got a point. Yeah. It's a bad term. But they'll have sexual intercourse, all the other male horses. So when it's born, all the other male horses are like, it's like a Maury Povich episode. They're like, it might be mine. I don't know. Like, so they leave it alone.
I guess I won't kill it. It might be mine. I don't know.
But that has to mean, right, that like the pregnant horse has some sense in some way that it's with horse child, right?
I think it definitely, it's one of those things that feels like the thing that's like so hard is like we cannot just ask animals.
Yeah.
We can't ask them like, do you know that you're pregnant? And like that is a thing that just makes it so difficult to answer this question with a great deal of knowledge. But one of the things that like is really interesting is that we can at least understand molecularly what's going on. And like that means that we can understand these behaviors as rooted in something that doesn't necessarily have to do with knowledge. So in the case of the mice, for example, scientists were really curious about how they make this shift from like murderous to maternal. And so they were looking at this type of brain cell called galanin neurons, which are involved in mating and parenting. And they looked in particular at how two pregnancy-related hormones, estradiol and progesterone, were affecting those neurons. And they found that estradiol made those neurons more sensitive to like the sound and the smell of baby mice. And that effect would actually fade as the pups grow up. But it was there. It's like part of like how they're kind of, I guess, responding to these pups. And then the progesterone was actually forming new connections between the neurons that made that overall like parenting circuitry in their brain become more efficient. And so when they looked at mice whose galanin neurons didn't have receptors for these hormones, they found that those mice who gave birth, they wouldn't actually nurse their young. So it was like they stopped doing whatever it was that was like their version of knowing, I guess, what it means to become a parent. So like overall, I think at least for this specific context, like this is work that's showing that, you know, pregnancy changes animal behavior and how much of it is just like that weird thing where like your brain and your hormones are just doing things and they're making you do things that you're not necessarily aware of. Like that's, I think, just kind of like the overall factor there. And I think I'm assuming for the horse, like that might be part of it. It might be that maybe, because this is I've read similar things for, I think, some gorillas, like, because I think silverback gorillas or some, I'm completely blanking on the species, but there are like other species of animals where males will kill the infants of other males. And so it's like, well, do they know who is whose infants, like what's going on there? And so it might just be that like, maybe it could be something, my best guess is like, maybe one of the female horses who's kind of just brain circuitry tripped on, hey, I should now mate with all the other males here. Like her infant survived, and that's like a behavior that could have been driven like biologically, and that got passed down through her young, and like was just something that kind of got continuously passed down biologically rather than was like a behavior that she was like, hey, I should do this, and we should all do this, and we should like knowingly with like full awareness do this.
I think the horse thing and the mouse thing are both like, as somebody with a kid, my brain is definitely different now, you know, kid on a plane, like I used to be really annoyed by children crying on planes, but now I'm like, kids just talking, like it's just saying stuff.
Yeah.
I'm just way less annoyed by it, which I find interesting as to why, but my guess is like anything, it's rooted in brain kind of structures and how our brains work. I'm just more used to hearing it is like the simple explanation, but I'm sure it's more complicated than that. And the horse thing is just like, maybe exactly to your point, it's a molecular change, you know, some kind of, there's a neurochemical change within the horse that the horse is like, it maybe doesn't know it's pregnant, but it's like, I'm feeling randy.
Yeah.
Because, and maybe it's feeling that way in part because of this pregnancy. And so it's just like a side effect evolutionarily of that, which is cool. That's cool to think about.
Yep.
And the mouse is the same thing. It's just an evolutionary side effect of having those babies.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Evolution is so weird because it seems like it means, like, when you hear about evolution, it feels like, oh, that means that evolution is trying to accomplish something. But, like, evolution's not really trying to do anything. It's just, like, the result of trying to survive. And so it's so weird.
Non-random selection of random mutations, right? Just, who knows what you're going to get? It's a crapshoot. And then
The
environment is like, you don't get to survive, some of you.
That's fine. Yeah. You died. Yeah. That's fine.
So there's another behavior in mammals that is also a thing that to me feels like, oh, but they must know. And it's something called diapause or embryonic diapause. And it's this thing that quite a few species of mammals can do where they can basically delay pregnancy. So they can mate at a particular time. They can start developing an embryo, but the embryo won't actually implant. And so instead, their pregnancy is delayed. And so there's around like 130 species, at least, that I saw that we know of that can do this. These include rodents, deer, armadillos. It can last for a few days, or it can be prolonged for as long as 11 months. Apparently, that's been observed in the Tamar wallaby. And I think actually the most famous example are bears, because they do this on a seasonal basis, where basically they breed in late spring or early summer, but the embryo won't actually implant in them until the female bear has like settled in. Like, she's eaten a lot of food, done a lot of hunting, her weight and her body fat are up, and she's like settling into her den for winter. Like, that is around when the embryo should be implanting and she will be pregnant. So
that's so cool.
Yeah, it's incredible. Like, it's basically like the body deciding, like, this is when you should become pregnant, which is so cool to me.
Yeah. Wow. Imagine if humans could do that.
Just
be like, man, had a real wild summer. I'm going to settle in for some Netflix and chill, but by myself, or whatever, with my partner.
Yeah.
And then you're like, whoop, hey, I'm pregnant.
Yeah. Yeah. It just seems, and again, it's like one of those things to me that feels like, well, they must just know to wait until like this time. And I don't know, like they get to press some switch in their body and that's when they're pregnant, or like, I don't know, like some muscle lets go and now they're pregnant. But
it's
probably just like a molecular thing again.
Yeah. Hormonal or something.
The body's just responding to conditions around them. Now the conditions are good and you can become pregnant. So those are the things to me that are just so weird in mammalian pregnancy.
That's so neat.
The body is just so weird and wired to do these things.
Wow. That's awesome.
So for me, I feel like as I was like delving into this question, I felt like I was starting to get really nitpicky about like, what does it mean for a mammal to know that they're pregnant? But I think it's because what it means for anyone to know anything, like it is really confusing. And animal cognition, like I was saying earlier, it's really hard because we can't actually like ask them these questions. And so we have to do all these weird roundabout experiments. And that helps us draw conclusions about what they may or may not know. And so that is kind of related to how like some people have thought about whether or not animals can know things about pregnancies. So one thing I was thinking about is the fact that a lot of people who get pregnant, they'll talk about their pet's behavior changing when they're pregnant. Like dogs in particular, I know dog owners will say their dogs get more protective of them. They're more caring. For Tiny Matters, we actually did an episode about like dog odor detection. And I think that's kind of explaining potentially what's going on here, because most likely there's all these hormones going on, like your smell is probably changing and they're probably just responding to something there. But like, we don't know for sure. I tried to see if any scientists had tested this out and I couldn't find anything. I did find one paper though, where scientists were trying to train a 2-year-old beagle to detect pregnancy in polar bear poop. Because
another
apparently it is very
surprising sentence. If Franklin was involved, that would have been the kicker.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of those moments where I'm just like, I love science.
Because
like some person was like, I got to write a grant. And their friend, you know, they're out at a bar or a restaurant or something. They're like, man, I'm working on this grant. Oh, yeah. What's your grant about? Beagles smelling poop.
Yeah.
To see if polar bears are precious.
Yeah. And in the abstract, they're like so understated. I think they're just basically like, yeah, it's hard to test polar bears for pregnancy. I'm like, yeah, I imagine it is.
Yeah, because they'll kill you.
Yeah. But so I guess that's where you get the beagles.
Yeah. And less lethal poop. So
yeah. Wow.
The bad news is that they were not very good at it. Or at least this one beagle was not. Like, the training didn't work very well. It sounded like the scientists were still optimistic in their paper. It sounded like they were just like, if we figure something else out, maybe it'll work.
We'll try it. We'll just keep trying.
We will solve this riddle.
Why a beagle? Do they smell
good noses,
better?
Right?
Probably, yeah. Are they hunting dogs?
They're hunting dogs,
yeah. Any sort of, like, hound dog, right? They're good at smellings, right?
I'm not a dog person. I don't know much about dogs.
Beagles, good at smelling.
But not polar bear poop.
But not polar bear poop.
Apparently, whatever they were looking for in the poop is not... That or, like, the beagle behavior didn't change much. The beagle was just like, ew, poop. Or knowing my dog, it would be like, ooh, poop. Because every time I'm walking my dog and there's some unpicked up dog poop, which is a lot in Los Angeles, my dog's like, what's going on over here?
Yeah.
Like, no, stop.
I was going to ask, like, does it have to specifically be dog poop? But I guess if you're saying poop out, like,
let's
most
not
likely.
Think
well,
too deeply
I did
about
used to
that.
Live in San Francisco.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It doesn't always like, dog poop.
There might be some very big dogs in the neighborhood. That's all I'm hoping. Okay. Like, yeah, and let's move on.
That's true. Yeah.
Bipedal dogs.
Yeah.
Another way to ask, like, do mammals know that they're pregnant is like, do mammals even know how to get pregnant? Do mammals know how babies are made? And there is a fantastic article from 2016 in Scientific American. So for any readers who want to dive deeper into this topic, I would recommend reading it. It's titled What Animals Know About Where Babies Come From. And it's written by an anthropologist named Holly Dunsworth. So the article is really like her kind of refuting the idea that animals know that sex leads to babies. And again, we can't actually ask animals this.
Sure.
So to kind of make her argument, she draws on research looking at how animals can know about other topics like physics. Sex, physics, they're all, you know, complicated, messy topics. So she was describing this experiment done by a primatologist named Daniel Povinelli that was basically asking chimps to sort objects by heaviness or like how difficult they are to lift. And I didn't fully understand it because I feel like understanding animal cognition experiments, I'm always like a little bit like the logic of them is always so confusing to me, I think, because I can't understand their brains enough in that way. But the outcome of that experiment is that it seemed like chimps were not able to do the kind of abstract thinking you'd need to be able to connect heaviness with like the difficulty of lifting something. And so to her, that suggests that at least like so far, we haven't really found signs of them being able to do the sort of cause and effect reasoning they would need to do to be able to connect like having sex to making a baby.
So what do they think they're doing? They're probably not thinking about it at
whatever.
All. Like, this is great.
Yeah, like, what do the horses think they're doing in the pasture? Like,
yeah.
They might just be like, this is fun. Like,
having a good time.
I don't know. Like, I just felt the urge and had to do it thing.
Yeah. And I focused on mammals, but it also did really lead me to wonder, like, also what other non-mammals think is going on, especially if they're making eggs. All those eggs just happen. And they're like, sure.
Yo, I had a weird morning.
I always wonder if insects or arachnids, like black widow spiders, you know, if the male black widows kind of know what's going to happen.
Like praying
next.
Mantises, they're just like, hey, girl, what's up?
I still think about it.
You sure you want to do that?
There's like a meme of like a praying mantis and somebody like removed the head and it's got its arms out like this and it's like near two other praying mantis and it's like, guess who got laid last night?
I saw a picture of a real praying mantis on the ground. Somebody posted on social media that had no head. And they're like, somebody had a good night.
Nice.
Yeah, like, top, bro. I guess the question is, like, would they not do it if they knew what was going to happen?
Let me say, as a man, I am dumb enough to go willingly to my death.
Yeah.
There are times, yeah.
I don't care what happens after. I'm in the moment.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I mean, it's funny because we were talking about, like, evolution. This feels like a thing that evolution would have been like, maybe that will not help you.
There was one mutant ancient human ancestor that was like, okay, cool. After we bang, probably in our, you know, youth, I kill you.
Yeah.
That's just part of the deal.
Yeah.
And they're like, that was the only one they made that evolution ever had.
Yeah.
Was done.
But they were really, really sexy, yeah. And so yeah. they won out the natural selection lottery. Listen, I know I exist on the internet. I see like men hitting on AI generated images of women. I'm like, literally, yeah. This is not something that exists.
Yep.
What are you doing? So speaking for men as a whole, yes, we would happily die in exchange for copulation.
Yeah, I think the AI is a little bit less dangerous than the prey mantis.
Wait until it has the nuclear codes. Yeah, and it gets hit on one too many times by people on the internet. Yeah.
And it didn't want to be.
It's like, that's it. Species over.
Well, so there are other factors that would also make it difficult for primates potentially to be able to understand, at least like based on what Dunsworth is kind of thinking through. One of them is like they just don't have communication that's complex enough to be able to kind of explain this to each other. It's also really hard to prove that animals have a sense of time that's long enough to connect the dots between mating and pregnancy. So like putting that cause and effect together would be, I don't know, like how would you think back to like, oh, however many months ago, like elephants are gestating for like 22 months, I think.
Yeah.
Are they like, oh, this is because of that time.
Like, 22 months ago.
What was I doing 22 months ago? Oh, right. I saw Harry.
Yeah. I haven't seen him in a while. Yeah.
Came over
for
some elephant wine. No. We put on elephant berry white. That's right. It's played on the trunk.
Isn't that called episodic memory? Like a lot of animals, they don't think have episodic memory, right?
Oh,
like they
yeah.
can't remember okay. yesterday versus today versus tomorrow. It's not that they don't remember things, but they can't always place them in time.
Yeah,
so they may remember that they copulated, but they won't place it as like, that was this many months ago.
Yeah.
And thus,
there's also the question of like, pattern recognition over multiple pregnancies, right? Like the first time that they're pregnant, are they like, what's happening? And then the second time they're like, oh, I get now why it's going on.
Yeah, we're going to get to that.
Yeah. Oh, good.
That's a very,
very
continue. Good point.
Please elaborate.
So this article was from 2016. So I don't know how far primatologists have like come since then on understanding like what we know about what they know, but I couldn't like find anything that suggested that we have found an animal that's figured it out. But that brings me to humans, because we have figured it out, but I have this question of like, how good are we at figuring this out? And so there's this book that I recommend to anyone who's interested in the history of pregnancy called The Myth of the Perfect Pregnancy, A History of Miscarriage in America.
Okay.
It's written by Laura Friedenfelds. It's just a super fascinating book overall. But in the first chapter, she talks about colonial women and how they would have approached knowledge of being pregnant. And I felt like that was a good proxy for like living in a world without modern tests, because like now it's very easy for us. Like you might think you're pregnant, very easy to confirm it.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that's important to keep in mind is that there are like obvious low tech signs that a person is pregnant, most notably like not getting your period anymore.
Right.
But this is like not necessarily a super reliable sign. People have irregular cycles. So like they can be impacted by other things going on in the world around them. So like it just makes it more difficult for a lot of people to know, just based on like, hey, haven't gotten my period in a while.
Yeah.
So in this era that Friedenfeld is describing, there were texts available that people could read if they wanted to look up signs of their pregnancy to look out for. She mentions this book called Aristotle's Masterpiece, which I love the title of because it is not actually written by Aristotle. She also cast aspersions on whether or not it is a masterpiece.
Aristotle, he had some weird biological theories. Like, he thought the brain was just for cooling blood. So, like, you know.
I also like the idea of, like, I'm going to write my own book, and I'm going to call this DeBokey's masterpiece.
I'm going to write this book. It's going to be called Dan Brown Writes Good. Read this one, too.
And in it, you are going to describe the science of pregnancy.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
It's very confusing for everyone involved.
It's just a book about botany.
Yeah. So some of the signs that in this book included were things like unusual food cravings, cramps, swollen veins under the eyes and in breasts. So like, you know, I think like by this point, there were like a lot of symptoms that people kind of, you know, had a sense of. Not all of them were super scientific, but like, you know, they were there. But also, pregnancy symptoms are super personal. Some people might have mood swings. Other people might have morning sickness. Other people have like all of the above. They have nothing at all. Like, it's just super, you know, personal.
It's interesting because in movies they would have you believe that like every person gets morning sickness
all the time.
Yeah. It's just like that's how you know 100%. That you're pregnant.
Yeah,
and it's like that's not a thing. It doesn't happen universally.
Yeah,
it's
like
really interesting.
I feel really smug about this, but like I don't get morning sickness. Like
well,
yeah, I know.
Hey, me
I was
neither.
Talking to my mom about it. She's like, "Yeah, we're just like a family that doesn't get morning sickness." I was like, "Well, yeah, great." So one of the things that's like super fascinating, I really love talking about miscarriage. I think like not just because like I've been through it and I think it's super important to talk about, but also I just think they're really fascinating. And part of the reason why I find this book, The Myth of the Perfect Pregnancy, really fascinating is she's actually really kind of tracing over time as we've gotten better about knowing about pregnancy earlier and earlier on in the pregnancy. That's like really kind of her argument is that that's really changed our relationship to miscarriage in general, because over time with more technology and medicine, we have this sense of control over pregnancy that doesn't actually match the reality. And so like, especially I know a lot of people who've been pregnant and I've had this experience too, like, you know, there's all these messages about like, don't eat this, don't do that. Yeah. It like gives this false sense of like causation to like, even if doctors will assure you like, hey, like nothing you could have done would have prevented this. It gives this false sense of causation, but that doesn't really track with the reality of the fact that like miscarriages are often like pretty much just like things that happen. Like making an embryo is really difficult. Making an embryo that lasts is difficult. And so, yeah, it's a thing that I have like very complicated feelings around, because there are also other social factors that affect the way that people experience miscarriage and it's like affects the rates of miscarriage and all of this stuff. So I don't want to say that it's strictly out of like our hands, because I think there are things we could be doing better in maternal care and stuff. But the book was just so fascinating to me because it made me like think more about how our relationship to this knowledge of pregnancy has changed over time, which is part of why this question was so fascinating to me.
Yes. I think I used to teach sex ed in college, and so we had to talk about some of the issues with pregnancy and how we think about pregnancy, because, you know, it was about sex ed. So it was teaching people, this is how babies come in. Mm-hmm. And there were people who were adults and didn't know. So, and didn't know that miscarriages even happened.
Yeah.
You know, there were people that were like, oh, well, once you're pregnant, you're pregnant. It's like, well, yeah, sometimes.
I think looking
on the person.
At the state of the world and country, I think a lot of people are very ignorant about the details of pregnancy and how
For sure.
And the myriad of ways that they do not result in a baby.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that was interesting to me, because I didn't realize it until you're pregnant, is that the date of your pregnancy is not tracked by the date of conception. It's dated by the like date
last
of your
menstruation,
last
right?
Period. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So like when people say 6 weeks pregnant, or they talk about a 6 week like abortion ban, they're really talking about someone who is at most known they were pregnant for like 2 weeks.
Assuming they have a perfectly regular cycle, right?
Yep,
and as soon as it's late, they're like, I'm late, right?
Yeah.
And they act immediately.
Right.
It's
but
wild.
Like people's cycles are all over the place. And so like 6 weeks between cycles is not uncommon.
For some people,
at
totally
all.
Normal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. How on earth do we really know, you know, without any sort of technological aid?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why it's like the history of pregnancy, the history of miscarriage, all of these things are just so interesting.
There are so many unknowns that we have sort of glossed over by saying, no, we know all of this stuff. We know everything about how embryos are built and how human bodies work. And thus we know all about this. But in reality, we are making a lot of guesses, a lot of educated guesses, but that doesn't mean that we have the control over the process. We don't at all.
Yeah. And so one of the things that makes it hard to know, too, especially, you know, you were talking earlier, Julian, I think about like, how do you know that you're pregnant the first time that you're dealing with pregnancy? A lot of those symptoms, like they might just make you think you're sick. Like if you just don't want to eat something, or if you're throwing up, especially, like it might just be that you think you're coming down with something that is not pregnancy.
Other affliction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like one of the things that Friedenfels was talking about in her book is like, yeah, like people who are going through pregnancy for the first time, they might not know. It was often like people who had gone through multiple pregnancies, they had a much better sense of their symptoms and they were like the people who could tell. She has this anecdote of, this is the most amazing symptom I've ever heard. This woman in the 1730s, she would get this weird cough when she was pregnant, and it was so distinctive that her neighbors would congratulate her when they heard it.
Wow.
Like, they all... Wow. They all
that
knew.
Woman, by the way, Ben Franklin's mom.
Yeah.
Wasn't he one of, like, 11 children? It could be.
What was the cough, I wonder? Did they describe it? Was it like...
No.
And it'd be like, oh, she's...
Harriet's pregnant.
Get the pink or blue glitter. But it'll be opposite, because in the 18th century, whatever.
Yeah.
That's another conversation entirely.
Yeah, were they doing gender reveals back then?
They were just like, congrats, it's not plague. That was the reveal. If it's green smoke, it's plague.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So one of the things for like then people in this era is like they might tell friends and family like if they suspected they were pregnant, but they often wouldn't like announce it until it was like really a point where they knew. And for them, what knowing was like when they could feel movement in like
the quickening.
Quickening.
Yeah, exactly. The quickening, which sounds like a horror movie to
me. It does. And it kind
of scary.
There's something growing inside you and now it's moving.
There are limbs just going up.
It's trying to punch its way out.
Yeah. So that's like around 4 months. So like that's, you know, that's like almost halfway
through.
Pretty far
into the process.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I feel like, I don't know. It's just weird to me because you could like suspect, then you don't know until you're like almost halfway through and it's because you feel something. For us as humans, the thing that helps is that like we can share knowledge with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like
right.
We have language. We can like share descriptions of symptoms. But if I couldn't communicate with anyone and like suddenly was like, huh, I've been feeling nauseous or I've been feeling this. And then like a few months in, feels like there's an alien in my stomach. That's not something you can necessarily know from like just watching someone else. Mm-hmm. Like I can't just like look at them and be like, so when they felt that way, they had a baby. Like, I don't know what it is that's going on inside of them that would then like correlate to baby and then like understand that in myself.
Right. If you can't communicate it verbally. Yeah. I did a video a long time ago about with some anthropologists and they said the power of humanity is our collective culture.
Right.
And that's exactly what we're talking about. And it used to be that this collective culture was solely passed down by women to other women because and like, I know all of this stuff about pregnancy because I am, you know, a midwife or a doula or whatever. I know I've been around pregnancy, either experienced it or just been around a lot of pregnant women and talked to them about it. And it's just like that was the way that we passed that knowledge down. And now it's become part of, well, it's on its way to becoming part of like the fabric of culture and understanding it more. So that's, which is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really fascinating. And I think like I hadn't thought about that at all. Like it was interesting to me that you mentioned like it was anthropologists who kind of were bringing that up because I hadn't thought about the cultural aspect of our knowledge until like I was reading Dunsworth's article and she's an anthropologist and she's like talking about the importance of language. And I was like, right, that is so important for like how we're able to convey this huge, significant part of what it means to be human. And like, all of these other like animals and organisms are going through the same thing too. And they just can't, as far as we can tell, explain it to each other.
Yeah. I think about this a lot, right? Because fundamentally, biologically, we're no different than humans from 600,000 years ago, basically, right?
Right.
If you
right.
picked one of them up and froze them and like brought them here and unthawed them and raised them.
Like the documentary Encino Man.
Exactly. Like the starring caveman Brendan Fraser. Yeah.
He just looked a lot like him.
It did. That thawed man. But yeah, they would just blend right in. Mm-hmm. So what's different? Well, basically, like we've been accruing and sharing knowledge and information in the intervening time. And that's basically what sets us apart from, you know, people who lived in caves and hit stuff with sticks, you know?
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. That's cool.
That's why we can write eulogies for squirrels.
Yeah. That's the difference.
That's
totally
used
worth
to not
it.
Be able to
what,
do that.
What advancements we've made.
We developed language just so Benjamin Franklin could write an ode to squirrel.
Skug.
Skug.
Sounds like a caveman name if there ever was
it does.
One.
I guess I'll, like the last thing I'll just say was something that we kind of talked a little bit about when we were talking about the praying mantises and like whether or
some
not
guys.
People would change their behavior if they knew like that they would die. So Dunsworth, she brings up in her article this like hypothetical about like if animals could know that sex makes babies, how would their behavior change? And one of the ideas that she kind of floats is that it might actually make them act more human. Like females might explore strategies to avoid getting pregnant if they don't want to. You might start to see like societies forming around family relationships. You might see like artificial insemination, like all these things that are like part of like human behavior we might start to see in other animals. And that's part of the thing that I think for me, like going back to this original question, do other mammals know? That to me feels like the most confirmation that they must not know, because they maybe I'm projecting onto animals or expecting them to project onto us now.
Like, again.
Yeah. Today isn't all about animal projection.
Well, Deboki, thank you for tackling this question. And thank you for, you know, also sharing with us something that I know can be really personal and being like actually a bit vulnerable with that. You know, it takes bravery, frankly, with a couple of, you know, dorks like us to just be like, let me tell you about my personal life and jump into that and like also try and make you laugh. So thank you so much for answering that.
Appreciate that.
When we come back, I will answer the third and final question of this episode. So stick around.
And welcome back to That's Absurd. Please elaborate. We've had two questions so far, both answered, both very oddly, both similar and different, mm-hmm. like lots of animal projection in this episode.
Yeah.
Weirdly.
Yeah.
Speaking of animal projection, though, Julian, tell everybody your question.
It's going to literally involve animal projection in multiple ways. It's quite a weird one. Let me just preface this. Like, the name of the game is absurd questions here, but still answerable in some way, right? Like, they can be semantically nonsensical. It has to be a question that I can attempt to answer. And this one, like, another one of those, like, every word in that sentence was a surprise. This question comes from Sai, and it is, how long would it take to complete a playthrough of Doom on a computer made entirely out of crabs?
So much to unpack there.
Sai, you know, goes in a little more depth. He says, it would take an estimated 600 years to complete the game on the MIT E. coli computer, and I was reminded of the 16 billion crabs article from a few years ago. That combination just got me curious. And all of this, look, I'm very online, okay? I'm very online. All of this was a surprise to me. I'm like, what is he talking about?
I've never heard of the MIT E. coli computer, and now I feel like such a bad bioengineer.
Wait, and I've never heard, I like that he just is like,
the 16, I'm like, what
everybody knows it.
Talking about?
Yeah.
So, first of all, Sai, congratulations on defeating me in Who's More Online. Like, you win this one. But let me fill you in. Okay, we'll work backwards. So starting with the MIT E. coli.
Wait, Julian. What is Doom?
Okay, I guess we should start there.
Yeah, I actually need this because I know so little about games.
I assume everybody's as much of a nerd as I am, but so I'll explain. Doom was a seminal landmark touchstone game. It's basically the invention of the first-person shooter genre as we know it. It came out in 1993 for PC and I think Mac, and famously it was a game that you could just like share over, you know, the internet and download or like burn it onto a CD and play it. You've probably, even if you've never played it, you've probably seen like what it looks like at some point. It's just like floating weird monsters.
Yeah, some of them are like D&D influenced.
Yeah, the premise of the game is a portal to hell has opened on Mars, and you, the unnamed protagonist, colloquially known as Doom Guy, are the only one who can stop it. And the game's famous for having like the gun coming right out of the middle of the screen, so it's kind of like you have a third arm in your chest. And anyway,
It just seems really easy to beat this. Like, you just don't go to Mars. Like,
yeah.
Hey, there you go. Leave Mars alone.
Elon.
We should be there anyway.
You hearing that?
Yeah.
So to make matters more confusing, a remake of it came out in 2016. Well, like a total reimagining, you know, and it's super good. But they also just called it Doom. So I'm going to assume that Sai is talking about the 1993 version of the game that involved a lot less computing power, which also makes my life easier for reasons I'll get into in a minute. Okay.
And just a sidebar here, Julian, Wolfenstein people want a word with you about it being the first person.
Okay, I'm just saying. Not necessarily the
just
first.
Gonna nerd you a little bit. Yeah.
Popularizing first person shooter genre, I would say it's like the reason for it. Okay. So now that we're all on the same page on what is Doom, let's talk about that MIT E. coli computer. From what I could find in February 2024, there was actually a grad student, Lauren Ramlin, programmed Doom to run on a display that was made of, instead of, you know, like pixels made of LEDs and stuff, E. coli cells.
Okay.
Yeah. Hmm. So
the computer itself is still a computer.
Yes, it's still an electronic computer, but the display it's outputting to is like a grid of cells, like a 32 by 48 grid. And then these E. coli cells can fluoresce when they're, you know, exposed to a certain signal, right? Yeah. Like a biological signal. And then like the computer will basically, to each individual pixel made of E. coli in this grid, tell it to either light up or not light up, you know, and you can form very grainy images on it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, do you know, is that part of why it takes so long to beat the game?
Now, I couldn't find any details on that. Here's what my assumption is, and that is that the refresh rate of this monitor made of living biological cells is very, very low.
Yeah.
For example, like your movies, moving images, video games, right? It's all an illusion. They are still images that are presented to us so quickly that it tricks our brains into thinking that it's actually something moving, right? When it's just a series of still images. And it has to go fast enough in order for that illusion to happen. Otherwise, it looks like a slideshow, right? So movies typically are at about 24 frames per second if they're on film. Digital, 30 frames per second. If you're a big film geek, 29.97 frames per second, fine. You know, video games, you want typically a higher frame rate because the action's smoother, and it also results in like less input lag. Like literally the image on the screen isn't there for as long. So when you decide to like click a button, you know, you have more accurate information when you're making a decision, that sort of thing. Games, you want typically a minimum of 60 frames per second. So my assumption is the E. coli display frame rate is really, really low. And so if you were to try and actually play through it at this low frame rate, like a slideshow, it would take a while. Now, let's talk about a crab computer.
tell me about crab. So, it's a delicious computer.
So this is not the same as a display made of E. coli, right? Because that's just like taking the output from some electronics and just showing you the results. Not so with the crab computer, okay? In 2012, scientists from the Kobe University, along with another scientist based in the UK, they came up with an actual method of performing computations with crabs. And it's basically the biological analog of what your computer is doing with electricity, right?
How?
I'm not the biggest computer science guy. I know I look like I really should be, but like to me, it's all kind of magic still. But I'll explain as best I can, right? And that I think everybody knows about how your computer uses zeros and ones to represent information, right? At a basic level, that's binary codes, right?
Zero, one.
And the reason we use binary in computers, right, like this base 2 system instead of base 10, like we're used to counting and representing numbers and stuff, is because we can represent a 1 or a 0 with an on or an off switch, right? So these transistors that are in the microchips that power your computer, they're the brains of your computer, right? They're made up of millions to billions of these little transistors, and these transistors either allow electricity flow through, so they're on, and that's a one, or they block it, they're off, and that's a zero. So that's the most fundamental level. The next level up is when we start applying logic gates to these transistors, right? Mm-hmm. So you can start performing calculations and manipulating the information coming through if you start applying rules to it. So the most simple gate in your computer is a NOT gate. And that involves just one input, like one transistor. If the transistor is in the on position, when that signal goes through the not gate will flip it to the off position. And vice versa. If the transistor is off, you know, the signal going through the not gate will output on coming out, right? So it's just an opposite.
Yeah.
Then there are gates that use two or more transistors, right? So you have OR gates where you have like transistor A, transistor B. If either of those is on, then the gate outputs an on signal. If both of them are on, it outputs an on signal. If neither of them are on, then it does not output an on signal. It's off. You've got AND, which is where both signals, both transistors have to be on. Any other combination, it doesn't output an on signal. And then you can further combine these. You can combine an AND gate with a NOT gate to create a NAND. You can combine it with a NOT and OR, you get NOR. And then it gets even more complicated. You can combine these even further and have exclusive AND, exclusive OR. And so these seven logical functions are basically everything that your computer needs in order to perform calculations and ultimately run programs and just do stuff with math. Just manipulate math.
Let us talk to each other over the internet.
Yeah, and share cat videos, you know, ultimately. The most important thing, right? Like, so these scientists in Japan, apparently they were on an island doing field research, a small island. I know Japan is itself a bunch of islands, but it was like a small island.
Depending on how far you zoom out.
I've got to be aware of pedantic people who are going to pop up in my messages, right?
Oh, there.
But they were at Funarua Bay in Iriomoto Island. I'm sure I butchered all of that. And they were at these lagoons, and they noticed that, like, there are these little soldier crabs, tiny little blue guys. They're really cute. And when, you know, the water comes in, they come out from their little burrows, and they scurry around in big groups. And they can be, like, hundreds to thousands of these little soldier crabs running around. And they were observing the behavior, and they noticed that, like, soldier crabs in the middle of the little group, they like to be in the middle of the group. They're like, okay, we're going to stick around right here. It's safe, you know, like we're in a herd. And then the ones on the edge of the group, instead of being like, let's go back to the middle where it's safe, they're like, we're going this way, everybody. And they just kind of lead a charge, you know, like a bunch of little soldiers, like just running around. And then waves and the natural swarming behavior, they kind of get engulfed in the middle. And then the former leaders kind of become little followers. And the new ones on the edge are like, all right, everybody follow me this way. And so they go like running off in that new direction. So they looked at this and being the fantastical nerds that they are, they were like, we can make a computer out of this.
I just want to reiterate what I said with Daboki's poop-smelling beagle. Science is the best. It's just the best.
Just the weirdest.
People are so
They're
nerdy.
So inquisitive.
It's the greatest thing. Yeah, I love it.
Right.
Ugh.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever looked at crabs and thought, like, yeah, computer.
No, how can I use
I can make that a computer.
to make a computer.
I've thought, I can make that lunch.
Yeah.
And even that's weird if you think about it. Anyway.
So they looked at these crabs, right? They're like, okay, first, let's see if we can, like, model this behavior in some way, right? If we can come up with a mathematical description that accurately kind of imitates how these crabs move around. And they accomplished that in their paper, right? The whole, like, leader versus follower, depending on position. They mathed that out. And then they were like, okay, well, let's say we design a series of hallways for groups of crabs to travel down, okay? If we arrange these hallways in a certain way, can these hallways function as these logical gates that your computer uses to process information? Okay, so I've shared an image from the study in our chat. And Daboki, do you see it? What is that? Can you describe that?
I mean, I can certainly try. So my first thought was that this looked like it was like out of a children's book. We're reading some book about like kids who are stuck in a maze, like a haunted maze, and they're just like in a mass and walking around. So I think what we're watching are, or what we're looking at are hallways shaped like little X's on this board. And there are little masses of black dots that I'm assuming are supposed to be the crabs going through these hallways.
Yep, that's exactly
it. There are red arrows indicating where they're going.
Yep.
And that is the computer.
Yeah, that's it. So specifically, this is an image of this hypothesized AND gate, right?
Uh-huh.
So you can see it's like basically an X shape with like a another fifth passage going straight up from the middle. And the idea is you've got your little groups of crabs, right? So an AND gate, to refresh your memory from a minute ago, is when you take two inputs, if both of them are off, it outputs off. If only one of them is on, it still outputs off. So both of them have to be on in order to output on. So the idea here is the crabs themselves, the group of like 20 crabs, represents an on signal. And they march together down this hallway. And when they come to the intersection, if they don't encounter another group of crabs, they keep marching off diagonally, right? So that still outputs off to this gate. Or if there's no crabs there, obviously no crabs go through. But if two groups of crabs come to this intersection simultaneously, instead of going off diagonally, they come together and merge, and they go straight up through that central fifth channel, and that is outputting on. So that is a logical AND gate.
Got it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Right.
And they just know the crabs are going to do this based on their behavior.
Right. But then...
Huh.
But then... Wait.
My brain hurts.
It's not... purely theoretical, they did it with actual crabs.
Oh,
yes!
No.
So they model this behavior, so they've constructed the different kinds of gates, yeah. Right? Like an OR gate is much simpler. It's just like basically a Y shape, you know? And then I guess they must have a NOT gate. I didn't see that in the study. But they actually built like an AND gate with like little acrylic walls, and they have like little starting areas for two groups of 20 crabs, and then like a little cardboard, like orange piece of cardboard behind where the crabs start. And the idea is they open the little gate, and then if they want to motivate the crabs to move, they like flip up the little orange card so it casts a shadow over the crabs, and the crabs think, ah, a bird, and they start scurrying. And then they tested how frequently they went down like the correct channel that they should go down to make the logical operation happen. And in a lot of instances, they did fairly well. Like if it was only one group of crabs, they would go down the correct like channel that would output like not on in the AND gate, like about 80% of the time. But when two groups came together, they went down the correct output channel that would output like on about 50% of the time. Like some of them would get lost.
Okay.
And so it would introduce like,
that's a lot of error
signal
correction.
Noise. Right. But the paper is like so optimistic. They're like, oh yeah, but it's still in the early stages of development. Like they're going to continue this line of like,
how big are these, like, these structures?
They're small. I mean, the crabs themselves, the soldier crabs, I mean, they can fit really easily in the palm of your hand. They're small little guys. So to get, like, a group of 20 of them together, it doesn't have to be very big. So the structure itself, like, fits...
It fits on a
tabletop, basically.
Because originally, I was like, in my head, it was like big crabs. It was like Squid Game, like arena style, like really big. But okay, it's a relief that it's like contained.
Here's an actual picture. That's pretty neat. That's really neat. It is quite small. What is that in the bin? That's like a sponge so that they wouldn't fall.
Yeah, I think so
that
you don't hurt the crabs. There's an
intimidation.
That's what
plates?
They call the orange plates that they flip up to create a shadow.
Intimidation plates. Oh my god.
The intimidation plates.
That's so funny.
Yeah, there's a little ethical statement at the end on like, we didn't hurt any crabs. Like, it's so funny.
I mean, to revisit again the beagle. It's not, you're at a bar with your friend, and it's just like, hope I get this grant. What's the grant for?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I wonder if I would have stayed in science if I knew that I could be doing
this motivates
experiments.
Me to get more involved. I'm like, you tell me I professionally can scare crabs? Like,
No, exactly. Like, if I had known that this is what I could have been doing with my time instead, like, I'd still be a scientist.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You
That's
had
amazing.
No idea
That's
this
so
was
funny.
Even allowed, but it is, apparently.
No, and it's actually, this, like, actually ties into one of my lab mates. His work was creating these kind of logic gates, but in human cells. And so getting them kind of like the E. coli to like light up under certain conditions. Yeah. And he created this incredible array of like all of these logic gates. And it took like years and absolutely zero crabs were involved. So like, we could have been doing this, Ben. Like we could have been doing this with crabs.
Yeah. But the fundamentals of how computers process things, right, can be applied to other systems. It's not confined just to electricity. And yeah, there are possible applications in like basically biomedical, making like tiny little biological machines, essentially. Yeah.
Yep.
It's very, very cool stuff. But there are issues with like predictability, basically the noise in the signal. And that's the problem with this crab pewter of the the number of crabs that don't properly go where they should to execute the logical operation. And so it messes up like whatever you're trying to do. Right. So you've either got to redesign the little crab channel or have some sort of noise correction, which would involve, I'm sure, more crab.
As far as I know, error correction is just running the same experiment through more than what, you know, probability. Mm-hmm. So you're just like run it through 10 different gates, the same calculation. And it's like, well, 70% of the time they pick the right one. So that's probably the right one. But again, I'm not a computer science
person. On the issue of more crabs, let's get to the 16 billion crabs story that Sai alluded to.
You remember
the insanity of this question? Let's make sure.
I thought this was the 16 billion crabs. No. Like, I thought we were going to find out that this involved.
Yeah. Debunky, this was 40 crabs. This is, we haven't even scratched that shell yet.
Sai, we're still unpacking the question.
I thought I was on a journey, and now I'm like, I was in one place the whole time.
The answer's going to take 2 seconds, honestly. We're just getting through the question. Okay. So I found a story from 2021 that the headline is, "You could run Doom on 16 billion crabs." And it was...
Luckily, it's a very specific number. So
it was alluding to this study originally from 2011. And apparently somebody said, okay, well, you should need, therefore, this many crabs for a logic gate, right? They said, like, you need 8 different groups of crabs for a bit, you know, so it's like 80 soldier crabs to run a single logic gate. And then, therefore, you would need, if you scale that up, 16 billion crabs to have the computing power necessary to run Doom. But I think the question is really like, at what speed are you running it? You know, because like, if you've ever tried to run something your computer's not cut out for, it will try, you know, it will go through the motions of attempting to do the calculations, and it will be slow, but it will try and get through it. So I think the question of the number of crabs is yeah, how quickly do you want to do it? If you have fewer crabs, you could probably still try and do it. But the question Sai asked was about time. How long would it take? And so I had to kind of dig back to, you know, the 90s, if we can all go back there for a minute.
Wow, there's so much neon.
Oh, cool.
Back here.
I've got a sweater tied around my waist. That's what I think of my favorite Power Ranger. Yeah.
You got it at the mall.
Oh, remember when brick and mortar retail existed? Those were the days.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
wow.
So when Doom came out in late 1993, a typical home computer would probably have like an Intel i486 chip in it, right? This is like your CPU. This is the brain of your computer.
486, yeah. Baby.
And this is also before dedicated hardware that was meant for running computer graphics existed, right? The GPU, graphical processing unit, that was invented in like the late 90s, I think like 98 or 99, by a company, disclosure, that I've worked for called NVIDIA. So this is what, you know, modern PCs use for graphics, because they're engineered to run calculations in parallel much more efficiently, which is good for outputting graphics, because to do 3D graphics, you have to do a ton of number crunching. But before that, in the 90s, we just ran it through the CPU, which just basically operates everything in sequence, like one after another, one calculation after the next. So it's more limited, but in the 90s, for like Doom, it was fine. It was enough.
Solitaire.
Right? So for 486... It has a clock speed, I'm going to estimate, of about 40 megahertz. So what that means is 40 million times every second, it does a cycle. And a cycle is switching the transistors on or off inside the chip, right? So the way that I tackled this question was thinking like, all right, a cycle is basically the time it takes for these crabs to run through a logic gate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That makes sense.
So how long does it take these crabs to traverse this gate? Well, the study doesn't say. So, except they did say when they put the crabs in their starting areas, they gave them about 2 minutes to calm down. So when they opened the gate, they didn't just like run off, you know?
Okay.
I'm going to assume that we're not going to do that every single time they need to run through a new gate. I'm going to assume that like it's a crab chain reaction. And once they're off and running, it's just continuous, you know, like let's just to simplify our lives. And then the question is, how long does it take their little crabby legs to scurry through this? Well, I found videos of them running along on the beach, and I just basically did a rough estimate. And I said, you know, I think it would take them about 10 seconds to get from their starting area, maybe collide with another group of crabs, and then head off down the correct hallway to perform this operation, right? This one cycle.
Right.
All right. So if the CPUs that Doom would run off in 1993 were capable of 40 million cycles per second, but our crab pewter can do one cycle every 10 seconds, then our crab pewter is 400 million times slower than our 1993 computer. You thought your 1993 computer was slow. No. Okay. So let's assume you're a really dedicated gamer and you don't mind that your E. coli screen updates like super slowly with every new image based on the crab pewter's computations, right? I looked up, all right, it takes Doom from 1993, actually running at a playable speed, takes a player about 5 hours to get through it, according to howlongtobeat.com, a website that I recommend if you're an adult who wants to play games but never seems to have enough time.
I was hoping you were going to do like the first-hand research.
I mean,
like, I looked it up.
No, it's been a while, but I'm also like really slow because I love exploring every nook and cranny. Mm. So, but HowLongTobeat, you know, aggregates people's times and says, okay, typically it takes people, if they're not doing the extra stuff, 5 hours. If they do a completionist run, like 9 hours, whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, so assuming you're just trying to do the bare minimum and it would normally take 5 hours, but your computer is 400 million times slower.
Those crabs aren't going to last.
No.
Yeah, you're going to need to breed new crabs while also playing the game. Are there even this many crabs in the world?
I mean, apparently if it's going to take 16 billion crabs, okay, then apparently it would take 5 times 400 million is 2 billion hours to play through Doom, which,
That's too many.
I know.
That's too many hours.
Too many hours. So really, if I calculate that in years, hold on, that would take you approximately 228,310 years to play Doom.
Wow.
Long enough for us to get to Mars and for an actual portal to hell to open there, in my conservative estimation.
Wow.
Yes.
Julian. This was amazing.
Yeah. This is so bizarre.
You got a definitive answer. Yeah. Is that the first time we've ever had a definitive answer?
It's really straightforward. You know, caveats, like I said, like I'm not the biggest computer scientist guy. This was my best understanding of how this all, I think, should work and making some assumptions on time. And
Give it really big error bars. 200,000
years.
Give or take 100,000 years.
Several trillion crabs over their lifespans.
This is weird. This is so weird.
Yeah.
I love it.
Long enough for the crabs to evolve into something else and then to evolve back into crabs as everything ends up being crabs again, as
true.
We know.
Wow.
Yeah. Fantastic. Super fun. So thank you, Sai. Thank you for that sublimely weird question.
Yeah. That was incredible.
So thank you. So fun.
Well, with that, we've come to the end of another episode of That's Absurd, Please Elaborate. And I have to say, this one was quite absurd. There were some
new benchmark.
There were some real absurdities in this one.
Weird.
I'm proud of us.
Go team.
Deboki, thank you for joining us on this episode, this landmark episode. Can you tell people where they can come find you if they want to hear your science writing or see or read or consume your content?
Yeah, so I work on a few things. I work on Tiny Matters with Sam, so I co-host that with her. I also write for a YouTube series called Journey to the Microcosmos, and I'm like in the background doing stuff for other podcasts and videos. And you can also find me on social media at OkidokiBoki. That's nice. OKIDOKIBOKI.
I love that. That's a really good one. Cool. Well, thank you so much for being here. I have to ask this one last question, though. Do you feel differently about squirrels?
Yes, I kind of do. Mostly because I feel so called out about my feelings about them.
This is a healing podcast.
Yeah. Now I'm going to look at the squirrel and I'm going to be like, is the problem me all along?
Wow. On that note, I don't know what a better way to end the podcast. Yeah.
We're really doing something here. I'm not sure what, but it's something.
So thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of That's Absurd, Please Elaborate. The show was created, written, and produced by me, Trace Dominguez.
And me, Julian Huguet.
And of course, the question answers were written by us and Deboki, our guest. It was also produced and edited by the wonderful and fantastically talented Kyle Sisk.
Who's never crabby.
Yeah, pretty much never.
Yeah.
And special thanks also to the listeners who submitted the questions featured in this episode. That's ADHD Newman and Cy, and of course, Deboki. If you'd like to submit a question, look for the form in the show notes. You can email us at hello@thatsabsurdshow.com, or you can go to our website, thatsabsurdshow.com/ask. Submit your questions, because that is literally how we got to do this weird adventure into crab kind. It would not be possible to do this show without your help. So thank you for that. And really thank you for everyone who is submitting questions. We are seeing every single one of them. And when they come in, we get them in our Slack, and it usually causes an outburst of us all talking about how great they are. So thank you for that.
Special thanks to those of you listening on Nebula. Nebula listeners get access to ad-free versions of our episodes. They can support us and other independent creators making great content. If you're interested, go to nebula.tv/thatsabsurdshow. And remember, save before you turn off your game of crab doom. You don't want to have to start again.
Oh my God.